Matthew chapter 24, our current series is entitled, Let Earth Receive Her King. And by that, I'm referring to the second coming of Jesus Christ, an event that all Christians are looking forward to. Jesus one day will come again. It's a future event. It's an event that I believe is approaching very rapidly. Matthew chapter 24 and 25 is our text. These chapters are referred to by Bible scholars as the Olivet Discourse. Basically, this is the second longest message of Jesus Christ recorded in the New Testament, second only to the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus delivered this message to his disciples privately while they were sitting on the Mount of Olives, observing the Jerusalem temple. That's why they call it the Olivet Discourse. In this message, he's responding to questions that were asked of him by his disciples. Questions that pertain to the end of the age. Neat questions. Questions that all of us are curious about. Hey, Jesus, what will the end of the world look like? What will be the sign of your second coming? What will it look like? Well, Jesus answers that question in the Olivet Discourse. Now, in our study so far through this book, or through this series, I have exposed you to a number of fancy theological terms that I think are going to become much clearer to you this morning. Lots of terms that people use in the study of eschatology, which is simply the study of last times, the study of future times. Millennialism has been a word that we've used. Refers to the literal 1,000-year kingdom that Jesus Christ will set up on the earth at His second coming. The amillennialist does not believe in a literal millennial kingdom. They believe in a spiritual one. The next event they're looking for is Jesus to just come back and judge. There's postmillennialism. Those people believe that the church is ushering in this 1,000-year kingdom. Jesus will come after that. The world will become more Christianized. And that's how the kingdom will be ushered in. Premillennialism is the fact that Jesus comes back a second time, then sets up a literal kingdom on earth. That's what I believe the scriptures teach. There's another term we've been using through our series, the tribulation, the great tribulation period, referring to the final 7 years of history, the final 7 years of this planet. The Great Tribulation, the Bible points to it as a seven-year period contained with all sorts of atrocities. There's another period that we've talked about, the Great Tribulation, the final 3.5 years of the seven-year tribulation, spoken of in Scripture to be even the worst days that man or this world have ever seen. There's another term we've talked about, the rapture of the church. That God's people, God's church, will be raptured from the earth before this tribulation period. Well, we've talked about a lot of these. This morning, we're going to look at some scriptures. And I'll warn you right now, get ready to lick your fingers. We're going to be turning a lot of pages. You're going to see more clearly how the sequences of end times events plays out in the Bible. It all begins, our journey begins this morning with a very important sign, a very distinct sign, an obvious sign that has great significance in the end time scenarios. Jesus refers to it in verse 15 of Matthew 24. Let's read it. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation. such has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. This is a sign that indicates critical condition for planet Earth. Things have been bad, but things will go from bad to worse before they become permanently better. That's the situation that the Bible paints. Let's look at this sign, some general characteristics of this sign before we actually figure out what this sign is. Verse 15, look at the term that is used for this sign. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place. Abomination of desolation, or if you have an NIV translation, the abomination which causes desolation. The Greek word for abomination indicates something that is absolutely disgusting. Something repulsive. We're talking about something that just makes your stomach sick. Listen to how different Greek scholars interpret this. A foul thing, a detestable thing, to feel nausea because of stench, to abhor, to feel a nausea or loathing for food. This is a disgusting term. It stinketh. It's gross. The Hebrew word also calls it disgusting. Both words are often related in Scripture to pagan idolatry, pagan worship, idols set up and worshipped as God in place of the true God of heaven. So it's something disgusting. The abomination of desolation. This thing, whatever it is, causes desolation. The Greek word for that is to make desolate, to lay waste, to despoil of, to ruin, to strip. So we're talking about a filthy, foul, disgusting sign that will cause desolation to commence. Notice something else about this sign. It's physical. It's tangible. It's visible. It's not mystical or spiritual. What Jesus says about this sign should be taken literally. You should not have to allegorize this sign away, which many people do. It will be visible, tangible. Look how Jesus speaks of it. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, this is something that people will be able to view. It will be observable. In fact, we even have a specific locale of where this sign will be. Standing in the holy place. Set, established, firmly fixed in the holy place. Now, without a doubt, the holy place here refers to the Jerusalem temple. Jesus, remember, is on the Mount of Olives checking out the temple. I imagine that maybe he even was pointing at it when he said, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place. Everything about this passage is Jewish. It's local. It's centralized in the Jerusalem area. Verse 16, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. The holy place here is Jerusalem, and specifically the temple in Jerusalem. So this sign will be disgusting, it will bring desolation, it will be visible, it will be located in the temple of Jerusalem. Another thing about this sign ushers in great distress for the world. For the people living in Jerusalem in particularly, but the Bible teaches that that kind of distress will spread worldwide. The focal point will be Jerusalem. Great tribulation takes place after this sign is seen. In fact, I believe that this sign marks the midpoint of the Great Tribulation. This sign marks the final 3.5 years of planet Earth where great tribulation commences, and it will be tough. Jesus gives some advice here to those who live and see that sign. He says, basically, get out of Dodge, folks. Take off. Run to the hills. Things are going to get bad. Verse 16, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. Now, that's an interesting statement. It speaks of great urgency. Houses in those days were two stories. They had one story that was enclosed. The second story was the roof. And most houses had a stairway, a staircase on the outside of the house that led to the roof. Oftentimes, families would hang out on the roof to enjoy the cool of the evening. Perhaps they'd have their barbecues on top of the house. It was kind of like the place where they hang out and recreated. Well, Jesus is saying, if you find out about this sign and you're on the housetop, go straight down the stairs and head to the hills. Don't even go inside your house. Don't get your belongings. Urgently leave the place. Verse 18, we see urgency. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. If you happen to be at work when you hear of this sign, or when you see this sign, Jesus is urgently saying, don't go back home. Just leave. Just flee. Don't go back and get any clothes. Don't get any belongings. Get out. Urgent. Verse 19. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. Some have tried to claim that there's a special curse placed on pregnant women in the tribulation period, or women that are in that kind of a situation. I don't think that's it at all. I think Jesus is just stating a fact of how difficult it's going to be for women in that situation at that time. Those that are pregnant or nursing babies, because, you know, time is of the essence here. It's get out as fast as you can, flee, go. Don't go back into your house. Get your belongings. If you got an infant, or if you're pregnant, it makes it a little harder to do that. I've got two children. I had to get a minivan in order to get everything in. And I have to tack on a half an hour to any journey that I'm going to take. And usually I'm still late. It's hard to get children ready. It's hard where you're in that situation. Imagine being asked to flee to the mountains in the wake of this sign that takes place. Verse 20 says, pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. Again, time is of the essence. Winter usually brings bad conditions for travel. It will be harder to flee as quick. Pray that it won't be on the Sabbath. Now, what does that mean? Well, Jews strictly observe a Sabbath day, don't they? And many times in their history, the enemies of Israel would invade Israel on the Sabbath day because everything shut down. There were strict travel laws, work-related laws on the Sabbath that you couldn't observe. And so, pray that it won't be on the Sabbath. Perhaps it will be much harder. People will be more tempted to wait till the next day in order to flee. This is urgent, isn't it? This tells us something about how hard the Great Tribulation is going to be. It's going to be tough. Did you know that Jesus is telling people to flee here? Now, that's odd. You should think about that. That should kind of surprise you, because most of the times in the Bible, what does God tell His people to do? Stand firm. Those who stand. Many times we're called to, as His people, stand firm with Him. Not so here. The command here is flee. Go. Get out. There's something about this sign that marks great terror, that marks great judgment that God is going to begin pouring out on the earth. Get out of the city. Go hide in the hills. Jesus himself describes it in verse 21. For then there will be great tribulation. Such has not been since the beginning of the world until this time. No, nor ever shall be. Great tribulation. Greek word, megas. Philipsis. Mega pressure. Mega affliction. Mega persecution. Mega anguish. Mega pain. Great tribulation. And Jesus himself says that this great tribulation will be unprecedented in history. Nothing that we've been through will compare to how bad this will be. And that's a scary statement, isn't it? Because I can think of some bad things that have happened on this planet. I can think of what happened when the Nazis tried to gain control. The atrocities under Stalin. Just recently in the former Yugoslavia. Recently what's going on in India. One author said, this description right here of the Great Tribulation isolates this period from all the inquisitions, pogroms, purges, massacres, and genocides of history. This will be unparalleled. And we've seen some bad things. It will be an unparalleled time. So bad that Jesus says in verse 22, if those days were not shortened, everyone would die. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. It's hard to imagine a time when the real threat is there of no one surviving. Unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, Jesus said. But for the sake of the elect, he does shorten those days. There's some interesting interpretations on that. The Bible is very clear that the Great Tribulation is a 3.5-year period, 42 months, however many days. There are those that say, well, Jesus could shorten that Great Tribulation if we prayed. I don't think so. It's all over Scripture. It will be 3.5 years. It will run its course. Well, what do you mean shortened? Well, there's some that think that that literally means each 24-hour day would be shortened. That the day, the actual day when the sun is out and it's light, would be shortened for the sake of the elect. It would get darker. People would be able to hide. There wouldn't be as much bloodshed if there were more daylight. That's possible. The Bible does teach that there will be a lot of cosmic disturbances in those days. My interpretation, however, is that when Jesus says, and unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, basically, he's saying, if those days were allowed to continue indefinitely, if the time of the Great Tribulation were allowed to run its course, no flesh would be saved. Instead, it's shortened. It's cut short. It's docked off. It's cut off. It's abridged. And as we'll find out next week, it's cut off very quickly with the coming of Jesus Christ. So I believe that's what Jesus is referring to. If those days were allowed to continue indefinitely, no flesh would live. So we have a description of great tribulation. It kicks off with the sign, the abomination of desolation. So what is the sign? What is that sign that kicks that off? Well, in order for us to find out what that is, we need to look at some other scriptures. The Bible seems to talk quite a bit about this event. And so I want you to prepare with me now to look at some scriptures that I think reveal what the abomination of desolation is. Let's start with the very prophet that Jesus mentioned in verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel, the prophet, standing in the holy place. So let's turn to the book of Daniel. Turn to Daniel chapter 9 with me. Daniel chapter 9. Daniel is an amazing book. Daniel was an amazing godly man. He was a prophet. He was taken captive, along with his people, Judah, by the Babylonians. He served in the courts of the king of Babylon and the Medo-Persians. And what's interesting about Daniel is he's given many weird, detailed prophecies. And this is written way back, thousands of years ago. And through these prophecies that God gave to Daniel, he was able to see what would happen from a historical standpoint, the world kingdoms. He was the one who predicted before it happened that Babylon would be in charge of the nation or charge of the world, then the Medo-Persians, then Greece, then Rome. All before the fact. Well, in Daniel chapter 9, he gets one of the most amazing prophecies. In fact, it sort of forms the backbone of all of Bible prophecy. The Medo-Persians are in control. Daniel is serving in their courts. He prays often to his Lord. And in verse 20 of Daniel chapter 9, a messenger comes to Daniel with a message. Let's read it. "Now while I was speaking, praying, and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of my God, yes, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, reached me about the time of the evening offering. And he informed me and talked with me and said, 'O Daniel, I have now come forth to give you skill to understand. At the beginning of your supplications, the command went out, and I have come to tell you, for you are greatly beloved. Therefore, consider the matter and understand the vision.'" Here's the prophecy. Here's where Daniel speaks of the abomination of desolation. Let's read this prophecy. 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall even in troublesome times. And after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the Prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate. What a strange prophecy, huh? But it is geared towards Daniel and his people. In verse 24, 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city. Who was Daniel's people? What was Daniel's city? Well, it was the nation of Israel and the city of Jerusalem. So these 70 weeks are geared towards the nation of Israel. Now, here's what's interesting about this prophecy, and that is the timing that is involved. It says 70 weeks. Now, what do you think of when you think of a week? I'll talk to you next week. What do you think? Well, the next group of 7 days, right? When we think of a week, we think of 7 days. That's how we use it in English. Well, here, the literal term for week is seven. So it could be 70 sevens are determined for your people and for your holy city. Seven what? Well, it could be a week of days. It could be a week of months. It could be a week of years. Turns out, I believe that he's referring to a week of years here. So we have 77-year periods. 70 times 7? 490 years. I think there's 490 years are determined for your people and for your holy city. Now look what happens in the first 69 weeks. Verse 25. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall even in troublesome times. So, we have 69 weeks there. We're given two events that serve as bookends for the 69 weeks. The decree to rebuild Jerusalem and then Messiah the Prince. When we studied the book of Daniel, there's a tape back there that we go into this in much detail, but I just want to briefly touch on this. We have a very clear date in history as to when the decree went forward to restore Jerusalem, to rebuild the temple. Artaxerxes did it. It's recorded in Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 1 through 6. That date would be March 14th, 445 BC. Okay, so that started the 70 weeks. We go 69 weeks of years from that date, March 14th, 445 BC. We have 483 years, 69 times 7, the first 69 weeks. 483 years times 360 days per year, 173,880 days. We all should have brought our calculator this morning, shouldn't we? So from March 14th, 445 B.C., 173,880 days later, guess what date that turns out to be? April 6, 32 A.D. Most scholars believe that is the very day that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, rode in on a donkey into the city of Jerusalem through that east gate. So from the period that that decree was given until Messiah the Prince arrived in Jerusalem, the triumphal entry, we celebrated on Palm Sunday. Amazing to the day. But this is even more amazing, verse 26. After the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. After the 69 weeks, until Messiah the Prince, he comes to Jerusalem. Hosanna in the highest, the Son of God is here. He's riding a donkey. The city is so excited about him coming. What happens 7 days later, a week of days later? They killed him. He was crucified. He was cut off. In fact, the Hebrew word Messiah will be cut off is a word that means executed as a criminal. So you can see that two events took place after those 69 weeks. Jesus was crucified. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Most people believe that that refers to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. There's one week that we haven't covered yet. It's called the 70th week of Daniel. Where did that week take place? Well, people try to say that took place in history. But let's read it. Look. Verse 27. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. I believe that the 70th week of Daniel is a future 7-year period. It has not yet been refilled. It's the great tribulation. It's the tribulation period. You say, well, that means there's a gap between the first 69 weeks and the 70th week. That's right. The church is a gap. The church age is a complete gap. It's called a mystery in the New Testament. The Old Testament prophets never foresaw the church. These 70 weeks are determined for your holy people, Daniel. This is Israel. We're talking about Israel. God stopped dealing with Israel when they rejected their Messiah, when Messiah was cut off. And so you begin to see the chronology, the sequences of events. Right now we're in the church age. There's a tribulation period coming. A 7 year, the 70th week of Daniel. There's no talk of a millennial kingdom happening in that time frame. It's always pointed to as after the second coming of Christ. So you see where the millennium now fits, after the second coming of Christ. The 70 weeks of Daniel are determined for God's, for Daniel's people. The church, I don't believe, is involved. Therefore, I believe the church is raptured before the 70th week of Daniel begins, before the tribulation. And as verse 27 says, in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate. What Jesus calls the great tribulation. Okay, Terry, very nice, very good. But you still haven't told me what the abomination of desolation is. What is it? Well, Daniel uses the abomination of desolation again in chapter 11 of Daniel. Just turn one page to the right. Daniel chapter 11 is one of the most detailed prophecies, chapters filled with detailed prophecies in the Bible. It has to do with the history of Greece. When Greece was in power, there were two kings that became famous. One of them became very famous in the history of Israel. The northern kingdom, Syria, governed by one of these generals of the Grecian Empire, and then another kingdom to the south in the Egypt area. Well, the north kingdom and the southern kingdom were vying for power, and they battled each other. The small state of Israel, Jerusalem, was right in the middle. And so whenever the northern kingdom would come down to fight against the southern kingdom, if he had a bad day, when he went back home, he'd sort of kick around Jerusalem. Sort of take out his anger and vent his frustration on Jerusalem. Well, there was one particular king who got way out of hand with this. And I don't want to read a lot of this, but just look at verse 29. And this is the northern king. At the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south. But it shall not be like the former or the latter. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return in rage against the holy covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. A lot going on in Daniel chapter 11, but the king that we just read about here, one of the northern kingdoms, he has a name. He's very famous in the history of Israel. His name is Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes was a treacherous king. And what we just read was an account of when he went down south to try to take over Egypt. He was stopped by ships from Cyprus. Most people believe that was referring to the Roman Empire, because the Roman Empire was beginning to gain power at that time. He was embarrassed, and so on his way back up north home, he stopped in Jerusalem. And it was at that time that history records he absolutely desecrated Jerusalem, the temple. He enforced that every one of the Jews would forsake their holy covenant. They could no longer sacrifice. They could no longer circumcise their children. They could no longer obey the laws of Moses. On December 16th, 167 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes slaughtered a pig on the altar in the Jerusalem temple. Pigs ain't kosher. They're not allowed. It would have been an act of absolute disgust. But he sacrificed a pig on their altar. He made the high priests and the priests eat pig's flesh. He also set up an image, an idol, in the holy place to the god Jupiter and to the god Zeus. That's an abomination of desolation. There's an image, there's an idol standing in the holy place. The religion of Israel has been desecrated. The temple has been torched. Was that the abomination of desolation that Jesus was speaking of? Well, no. Jesus is referring to the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel as still future. This account in Daniel chapter 11 did happen. It was an abomination of desolation. It was predicted by Daniel. However, there's a future one that's coming. Jesus referred to it as future. And you know what we can learn from Antiochus Epiphanes and from what he did? Well, that gives us an indication of what this sign is. There will be an idol. There will be an image. The Jerusalem temple will be desecrated. False worship will be asked for in the holy place. That's a sign. Well, does the Bible speak of something like that happening in the tribulation period? Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation, flee to the hills. Get out of town. There are those that say that the abomination of desolation that Jesus was talking about happened in AD 70. When Rome, under Titus, came in, destroyed Jerusalem. The Romans put up ensigns and they worshiped them in the gates of the city. Luke chapter 21, I believe, is looking at that event. Actually, it could be Luke 20. Luke 20 or 21 is talking about that event, the parallel version of Matthew 24. I don't believe it happened in AD 70 because in Matthew 24 and in Luke it says that Jesus comes back. The sign of Jesus, the Son of Man, coming in the clouds comes back. That didn't happen in AD 70, folks. That wasn't the greatest time of tribulation that the earth has ever seen. AD 70. The Romans come in and tear down a temple. No, there's something about Matthew 24's reference to abomination of desolation that is still future and more horrid. And folks, there is such a place that the Bible speaks of it. Turn to Revelation chapter 13, and this will be our last passage. Revelation 13. In this chapter, the Apostle John explains the vision that he was given of the rise of the Antichrist in the tribulation period. Verse 1. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of the heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worship the dragon who gave authority to the beast. And they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And he was given authority to continue for 42 months, 3.5 years. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. It was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs, so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666. We have an unholy trinity going on in Revelation chapter 13. Satan always wants to counterfeit what God does, and we know that God is a triune God. God the Father, God the Holy Spirit, God the Son. The dragon is sort of like Satan's version of the Father, giving power to a first beast that comes out of the sea, who I believe refers to the Antichrist and is a counterfeit of Jesus Christ, the Son. He is a world leader. It's granted him to make war with saints, and authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. This world leader will deceive the world. Then in verse 11, we have a second beast that comes out of the earth. He's labeled the false prophet by many end time expositors. He's sort of a support role for the Antichrist. He comes from a religious point of view. He can work signs and wonders. Many people believe that's Satan's counterfeit of the Holy Spirit. So you have an evil, unholy trinity taking place on planet Earth in the tribulation. And folks, verse 14. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast. Verse 15. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. What do you think that is? I think that's the abomination of desolation. Where do you think it will stand? In the holy place, in Jerusalem, in the temple. What happened under Antiochus will happen again, only much worse. An image of Satan himself in the holy place, in the temple, in Jerusalem, and technology will be in place such that those who do not worship the beast can be busted. The Bible does teach there will be martyrdom like never before. That's why it will be better for you to flee the cities. Be better for you to run to the hills. Because at that point, not only do you have all the earthquakes, all the famines, all the wars, all the birth pangs getting closer and closer, but now you have widespread persecution. Sound weird to you? Sound unbelievable? Listen to what Paul the Apostle wrote concerning the coming Antichrist. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, "Let no one deceive you by any means, for the day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God." That's the abomination of desolation. And that will mark the midpoint of this tribulation. How do I apply that to my life, Terry? What do I do with that information? How's that going to help me tomorrow morning in the real world? Well, you need to understand that there are spiritual forces and non-spiritual forces that are competing for your worship. Satan himself wants to be the object of your worship. Look where he's going. Look where he wants to go. He wants to be in the holy place, man. In Jerusalem. Standing before the world. Worship me or die. That's what Satan's going to. That's where he's headed. There are forces competing for your worship, my friend. You say, "I'm not a Satan worshiper. I don't do weird stuff like that. I don't even celebrate Halloween." Satan is called the god of this world, and he has many lures. He has materialism. He has fame. He has power. Anything that can get us away from true worship of the Holy One, the true God of heaven and earth. God will not share his glory with any. The Bible teaches that God hates idolatry. Especially a man sitting, standing in the holy place, requiring worship. It's an abomination. Is there something competing with God in your life for worship? We talked about an abomination that causes desolation. Folks, if you have something in your life that's higher than God, it will bring you to a state of desolation. They'll bring ruin. It'll despoil you. It'll rob you. God will not share his glory with any. His first two commandments: "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain." That's just a command for the Old Testament, Terry. Really, listen to what Jesus said in Matthew 22. "Teacher," somebody asked him, "what is the great commandment in the law?" Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment." There are forces in place competing for your worship. God doesn't have competition. He shouldn't. Nothing could compete with Him. He's the one true God. As days come to a close on planet Earth, it will become much more clear-cut who you worship. Who do you worship now? Who's first place? You don't think Satan wants your worship? Believe it or not, he one day asked Jesus Christ himself, the Son of God, to bow down and worship him. You remember in the temptation? Again, the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in their glory. And he said to him, this is Satan, "All these things I will give you if you will fall down and worship me." Jesus said to him, "Away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only you shall serve." Let this be a strong exhortation for God's people not to lose focus. Don't let anything become an abomination of desolation in your life. Worship him. Worship him alone. Let him be our focus. I heard of a 3-year-old girl. She did something to that praise chorus, "We Exalt Thee," that made it take on a whole new meaning. You know that praise chorus? "We exalt thee, we exalt thee." This 3-year-old girl misunderstood the words and she was singing, "We exhaust thee, we exhaust thee." When I read the Old Testament, I see a God who gets very, very tired of people that turn their backs on Him. People that He's been so good to. People that He's shown such grace and love and mercy. Do we exhaust Him? Or will we not exalt Him? Right now, today. Let's all stand and bow our heads as we do that.